So, when you look at modern natural safety today, there's this overwhelming expectation of just like total engineered precision. I mean, I was looking through a massive stack of case studies for today's deep dive, and you see the exact same pattern everywhere.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The dense safety manuals, the rigorous compliance audits.
Right, the zero harm certifications, you look at a corporate dashboard, and the indicators are all flashing green, so, everyone assumes the system is perfectly secure.
It creates this really powerful sense of objectivity. We see numbers, we see completed checklists, and we just assume that because a risk has been quantified on paper, it's somehow been neutralized in the real world.
Yeah, we love knowing that a box was checked. I mean, it lets everyone sleep at night. But then you look past those dashboards and step into the reality of what happened on June 17, 2026 in Los Angeles. And suddenly, that comforting illusion of control just completely shatters.
It really
We're
does.
looking at a catastrophe that basically proves all those greenlit checklists can actually blind an organization to a system that is melting down from the inside.
The June 2026 Boyle Heights warehouse fire is, well, it's the absolute definition of a systemic illusion. And it's a textbook example of why relying on legal liabilities or, paper metrics as your primary defense is just so incredibly dangerous.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are pulling a very specific, newly uploaded document from our stack of sources. It's an analysis by Rosa Antonia Carrillo titled simply The Boyle Heights Case. Docs.
And this document serves as a real-time validation of the core arguments from her newly released book, Unmasking Safety's Myth of Individualism.
Exactly. Our mission for you today is to look right past the physical ashes of that fire and uncover the invisible systemic failures that actually cause modern disasters.
Because disasters of this magnitude, they never happen simply because a single wire sparked or a single valve broke. I mean, those are just the final visible triggers of a collapse that's been happening quietly for years.
Okay, let's unpack this, because there is a central paradox presented in this document that's going to drive our entire conversation today. Like, why do industries with the most rigorous safety checklists and the most intense compliance audits keep experiencing these catastrophic, deadly disasters?
Right. It seems entirely backward.
Yeah. And the author introduces a deeply unsettling concept here, which is that the very idea of relying on individual responsibility might actually be making our systems far less safe.
What's fascinating here is how the physical destruction of the Boyle Heights warehouse perfectly mirrors the organizational rot that Carrillo writes about. The central thesis we're exploring today is that safety is never just a transaction.
No, not at all.
It's not a legal liability you can just outsource, and it's certainly not a paper checklist you can file away. Safety is a fragile, ongoing social achievement. When leadership prioritizes the paperwork over the people and the environment they work in, well, the entire architecture is just primed to collapse.
So to really understand how that compliance blueprint fails, we need to walk through the terrifying physical mechanics of the Boyle Heights fire itself. We have to look at the human suffering it caused.
It was devastating.
I mean, imagine this massive cold storage warehouse operated by Lineage Logistics, right? And it's situated right in the middle of a working-class neighborhood. A fire breaks out, and this massive toxic chemical plume rises into the sky. It leaves the surrounding community literally trapped in their sweltering homes, just breathing in fumes of burning polyurethane and ammonia.
And the structural design of this warehouse is really crucial to understanding why the fire became such an unstoppable nightmare. It was engineered for maximum refrigeration efficiency.
Right.
So you can picture essentially like a giant industrial thermos. The building featured heavy corrugated steel walls, and packed inside those walls was 8.5 inches of highly flammable polyurethane foam.
8.5 inches of plastic foam just wrapping a massive building. And on top of this giant cooler sat a state-of-the-art green energy solar panel array. So on the afternoon of June 17, a third-party electrical contracting firm was up on that roof performing routine testing. And suddenly, a thermal ignition occurred.
And what followed was perhaps the most challenging scenario a modern fire department could ever face. As the fire ignited that thick plastic foam insulation beneath the roofline, the structural support of the building just rapidly failed. thousands of these heavy metal-backed solar panels collapsed inward.
They just pancaked down on top of the burning insulation.
Exactly, they pancaked right down.
The source document calls this a literal solar panel armor over the blaze, and the physical reality of that is just staggering. I mean, firefighters were dumping 12.5 million gallons of water a day onto this fire, but the water just hit the metal backs of those collapsed green energy panels and drained off harmlessly into the streets.
Which is just a terrifying image.
Yeah, and underneath that impenetrable metal shield, the toxic zone and the refrigeration lines, which, by the way, were carrying 12,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia, they just burned fiercely. The core of the fire was completely out of reach.
It was a perfect storm of modern engineering actually preventing the rescue effort.
Boyd, I'm getting stuck on something here. You're talking about green energy panels and updated emergency response plans. I mean, on paper, that sounds like a company doing exactly what society wants them to do.
You know? Checking all the progressive boxes.
Yeah, they're trying to be sustainable. They're getting their plans certified. Are you saying the safety measures themselves became the hazard? How does a literal facility upgrade become the very thing that traps the fire and makes the disaster worse?
Well, that paradox is the exact metaphor Carrillo uses to explain the failure of modern corporate safety. Think about those metal solar panels physically shielding the burning core of the building from the firefighters' water. Corporate executives use paper audits, zero harm certifications, and bureaucratic safety checklists in the exact same way.
Wow. Yeah, they build a shield of paperwork to insulate themselves from the messy lived reality on the front line.
So the compliance metrics literally become a psychological armor. The dashboard looks green, so the executives just don't have to look at the actual building.
Exactly. They are completely insulated from the reality of their own risk. On paper, this warehouse had a flawless emergency response plan that was approved just weeks before the fire. The compliance dashboard looked perfect, but the underlying social and physical circuitry of that facility was already melting down.
Because they couldn't see past their own paperwork?
Right. The executives couldn't see the danger because their own safety metrics were blinding them to it.
So when a company builds that kind of armor, and the executive suite is just totally insulated from the reality of their operations, they start missing what's happening right in front of them.
They miss the obvious signs.
Yeah, and the document asks whether there were warning signs before the 2026 fire broke out. To answer that, Carrillo's analysis requires us to look back 16 years to a remarkably similar world-famous disaster, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion in 2010.
Right, where 11 workers perished in the Gulf of Mexico. The connection Carrillo draws is that both Deepwater Horizon and Boyle Heights were preceded by what safety experts call weak signals.
Weak signals, yeah.
These are early, often really subtle warning signs that the organization actively chooses to normalize or just ignore. Because disasters of this scale, they are never sudden surprises. The system always warns you before it breaks.
At Deepwater Horizon, the offshore drilling industry relied on this massive piece of equipment called the Blowout Preventer, or the BOP. It was a complex, multi-ton safety critical element sitting on the ocean floor, and it was designed to shear through the drill pipe and seal the well in a catastrophic emergency.
And the industry treated the BOP as their ultimate physical shield. Just as Boyle Heights relied on paper compliance and its solar setup, the drilling executives assumed the BOP would just save them no matter what happened above it.
But it didn't.
No, it didn't. And Carrillo's analysis points out a crucial mechanism of failure here. When the underlying social architecture of an organization breaks down, the technical controls inevitably fail right alongside it.
Meaning, it wasn't just a mechanical failure of a valve down in the ocean. The failure started with the people.
It started with the immense production pressure placed on the crew. I mean, managers were pushing to finish the well quickly to save millions of dollars. They were overriding caution, skipping critical cement tests, misinterpreting pressure readings just to keep the operation moving.
And they broke the social system first.
Exactly. When you strip away the social safety net, when workers feel they can't speak up without slowing down production, you are fundamentally breaking the machine. The BOP failed at Macondo because the culture failed first.
And when we bring this back to Boyle Heights, the warnings weren't just abstract pressure readings. I mean, they had a literal precursor roof fire at the exact same Los Angeles facility in 2024.
A fire on the same roof?
The roof caught fire 2 years prior to the catastrophic meltdown.
And a precursor event like that, it should freeze an organization in its tracks.
Okay.
It should trigger a deep systemic inquiry into the structural vulnerabilities of pairing high-voltage solar panels with highly flammable polyurethane foam and 12,000 pounds of toxic chemicals.
You would think so.
But instead, the near miss was simply normalized. They extinguished the fire, replaced the damaged parts, and went right back to business as usual.
Here's where it gets really interesting. You know what this reminds me of? It's like a driver ignoring the check engine light on their dashboard just because they passed a written emissions test last month. And then instead of taking it to a professional mechanic, they decide to rewire the engine themselves in the driveway, in the dark, without a manual.
That is a very accurate analogy.
Right. Because following that 2024 fire, the company performed multi-million dollar electrical repairs entirely off the grid.
They bypassed city permits entirely. They completely bypassed municipal building inspections.
They literally just built it themselves without telling the city.
It is a staggering example of what the author calls the myth of individualism in action. Leadership essentially treated safety as a simple transaction of cost control. By not pulling permits and not waiting for inspectors, they saved time and money in the short term. They satisfied their own immediate comfort.
Wow.
But in doing so, they were completely blind to the fact that their organizational circuitry, their culture of reporting, oversight, and systemic safety was in an advanced state of decay.
So when a company bypasses those permits and ignores those glaring weak signals, they're basically building a massive house of cards. And when it inevitably falls down, their immediate survival instinct isn't to look at the foundation they built. According to the document, the corporate system immediately deploys a defensive script to protect the power structure.
Yeah, the immediate corporate instinct is always to hunt for the bad apple. They scramble into the physical wreckage, not to understand the systemic failure, but to find the specific individual whose human error pulled the trigger. They need a singular face to blame.
And we saw this post-fire deflection immediately in Boyle Heights. Lineage Logistics strictly distanced itself from any operational blame. They pointed the finger entirely at the third-party testing contractors who were up on the roof. They pushed a narrative that said it was their human error, they sparked the fire, this is totally on them.
And their public relations defense bordered on the absurd, really. They insisted in public statements to the media that they store food, not hazardous materials.
Which is just a wild statement to make when your facility is actively housing 12,000 pounds of highly toxic anhydrous ammonia right in the middle of a residential zone.
It's deflection. Curio compares this directly to the legal theater that followed Deepwater Horizon. After the Gulf oil spill, the justice system focused its energy on prosecuting two frontline workers, the well site leaders who were on the rig that night.
Just the guys on the rig.
Right. The legal system prosecuted the individuals at the sharp end to satisfy the public's intense demand for blame and blood. But they left the executive systems, the relentless production pressure, the massive cost-cutting directives, the ambiguous safety protocols dictated from headquarters, completely unchecked and unchanged.
But let me play devil's advocate for a second here, because I think a lot of listeners might be wondering this. If a third-party contractor is up on a roof and someone drops a wrench or wires something incorrectly and sparks a massive fire, I mean, they did start it, shouldn't the person who lit the match be held responsible? Isn't holding them accountable just common sense?
Well, it feels like common sense because our society is deeply conditioned to look for a singular villain. But Carrillo identifies this as the scapegoat mechanism and explains why it is such a highly dangerous trap.
Okay, how so?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, blaming the contractor is a convenient fiction. It acts as societal comfort food. Yes, a specific worker may have created a spark, but scapegoating that individual protects the parent company's unpermitted construction. It protects the unresolved safety violations that Kel OSHA had previously flagged at that facility. It protects the systemic cost cutting that set the stage for the accident to happen in the first place.
So we focus all our anger on prosecuting the guy who dropped the match, but we completely ignore the executives who chose to build the room out of dynamite and soak the floors in gasoline.
That is the exact dynamic. The danger of the scapegoat mechanism is that it cleanses the system temporarily without actually fixing the dynamite in the walls. Blaming the individual ensures that absolutely nothing about the risky environment actually changes. The corporate system absolves itself, goes back to business, and just waits for the next spark.
Which naturally leads us to ask, why did the city or the state let them build the dynamite room to begin with? I mean, why was this specific facility allowed to operate with unpermitted repairs, a history of fires, and massive amounts of toxic chemicals without severe regulatory intervention?
That brings us to the most uncomfortable question of the deep dive. The source material introduces a concept here called demographic complacency. And this is perhaps the most critical mechanism we've discussed so far.
Demographic complacency.
Yes. It's an unconscious bias that allows companies or even a municipality's risk tolerance thresholds to shift depending on the socioeconomic makeup of the neighborhood where an industrial facility is located.
And Carrillo's analysis points out a stark statistical reality about this neighborhood that just cannot be ignored. The demographic reality of Boyle Heights is that the community is 96% Latino, and it is strictly working class. The per capita income there is half the Los Angeles County average. And crucially, nearly one in three households completely lack air conditioning.
And when you understand those demographics, you really understand the brutal, disproportionate impact of a disaster like this. When the fire broke out and the toxic plume covered the neighborhood, public health officials issued standard warnings telling people to stay indoors and close your windows to avoid the smoke.
But practically speaking, a third of these homes don't have AC. So you have thousands of low-income families living in older pre-1940 rental homes who are now trapped indoors, sweltering in the brutal summer heat, just to avoid breathing in polyurethane and ammonia fumes. They're literally bearing the physical cost of the company's risk.
The author asks a really pointed hypothetical question that reveals the core of demographic complacency here. Would the operators of this warehouse have been allowed to conduct multi-million dollar off-the-grid electrical repairs, completely bypassing city inspections and fire marshals, if this facility were located next to the multi-million dollar estates of Newport Beach, California?
So what does this all mean for the people living there? The honest answer drawn from the document is a resounding no. A wealthy municipality would have had inspectors all over that building the moment a single permit was skipped.
Yeah.
It is just chilling to realize that the lack of local political power or lack of municipal wealth essentially subsidized the corporation's risk-taking.
This raises an important question about environmental injustice. The analysis argues that when we allow neighborhood demographics to dictate our safety standards, we are no longer engaging in risk management. We are committing an act of environmental injustice.
Yeah.
A system infected with demographic complacency exposes the most vulnerable segments of our workforce and our communities to catastrophic harm simply because the organization feels confident they can get away with it.
It's a heavy realization, knowing that the regulatory shield is often just as illusory as the corporate one. But the document doesn't just leave us staring into the ashes of this warehouse, knowing all of this, that the paper shields fail, the system defaults to scapegoating individuals, and that unconscious biases like demographic complacency leave vulnerable communities exposed. How do today's leaders actually break this cycle of failure?
Well, Carrillo provides a blueprint. She provides a very specific strategic blueprint for moving away from the illusion of being paper safe toward a resilient, relationship-centered reality. And she lays out two core recommendations for what she terms risk navigators, basically the leaders and managers responsible for steering these massive organizations.
Okay, so the first recommendation is to operationalize your sociotechnical systems iceberg, or the STS iceberg. Let's break that down.
Right. So traditional safety management is obsessed with the tip of the iceberg. You know, the visible events, the paper-thin certifications, the compliance audits. To fix this, leaders have to understand what a socio-technical system actually is.
It's the people and the machines.
Exactly. It means recognizing that the social aspects of your company, the way people talk to each other, the power dynamics, the fear of speaking up, those are engineering components just as critical as the technical pipes and wires. You cannot engineer a safe technical system without engineering a safe social system to operate it.
And to do that, Carrillo argues you have to dismantle the compliance dynamic. You have to take your safety personnel and move them away from being box-checking enforcers who just walk around issuing citations. They need to become safety facilitators who actually partner with the frontline crews to solve problems in real time.
And a major part of that shift is bridging the linguistic divide between the boardroom and the frontline. Executives have to learn to listen to the embodied language of their workers.
What does she mean by embodied language?
Well, when a worker is talking about exhaustion, heat stress, or feeling like they are flying by the seat of their pants, which, by the way, is the exact phrase the crew on the Deepwater Horizon rig used in emails just days before it exploded, leadership cannot dismiss that as mere whining or complaining.
Because those feelings are vital risk sensors.
Yeah.
They're detecting systemic danger long before a technical instrument on a dashboard flashes red. And to tap into those human sensors, the document emphasizes employing a technique called humble inquiry.
Yes, humble inquiry is key.
So instead of walking onto a site after an incident and demanding to know who screwed up, a leader asks why that specific action made sense to the worker at that time. I mean, it completely changes the paradigm from assigning blame to understanding context.
It does. And the second core recommendation for these risk navigators is to actively audit for demographic complacency. Organizations have to ruthlessly interrogate their own operations. They need to look at their map and ask, you know, are our risk tolerance thresholds shifting based on the zip code of the facility? Are we ignoring a near miss or a maintenance delay in a working class neighborhood that we would instantly fix if it happened in a wealthy suburb?
It requires a brutal level of honesty about unconscious bias that most corporate structures are just designed to avoid. So, synthesizing this for you, the listener, instead of designing a safety culture like a rigid metal shield, like those metal-backed solar panels that eventually collapsed, trapped the heat, and made the disaster worse, you're building a nervous system.
A nervous system, exactly.
You want an organizational nervous system that actually feels the pain at the extremities, listens to the weak signals, and reacts intelligently before the whole body collapses.
Leaders must tear down the armor of compliance. We have to realize, as the author powerfully states, that we do not create safe workplaces through top-down edicts, zero-harm posters, and paper audits. We create the social conditions under which safe work can actually be done.
It's a really profound shift in how we view industrial operations. Let's just briefly recap our journey today. We started by exploring the tragic physical metaphor of the Boyle Heights warehouse fire. We saw how a green energy solar panel array physically shielded the blaze, worsening the disaster, just as corporate paperwork shields executives from operational reality.
And we saw how that echoed the unheeded warnings and the legal theater of the Deepwater Horizon explosion.
Mm. Right, where complex technical systems failed because the social architecture collapsed first. We uncovered the harsh truth of demographic complacency, where a community's lack of wealth basically subsidizes corporate risk-taking. And finally, we laid out Kirill's blueprint, treating the frontline as vital risk sensors, utilizing humble inquiry and building an organizational nervous system rather than a metal shield.
It ultimately comes down to moving past the comforting illusion of individual blame. We have to recognize the incredibly complex social web that actually keeps a facility and a surrounding community safe.
I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over on your own as you step back into your day. We spent a lot of time today talking about massive industrial disasters, oil rigs, and corporate executives ignoring the embodied language of their frontline workers. But think about your own daily life.
Yeah, your own spheres of influence.
Think about your own team at work, your community, or even your family. When the people around you are operating in survival mode, when they are stressed, burned out, or telling you they're flying by the seat of their pants, are you really tuning in to those weak signals? Are you asking why their actions make sense in that moment? Or are you just checking the boxes, pointing to the rules, and hoping your armor holds?
It's a fundamental question about how we interact with the systems and the people we rely on every single day.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Boyle Heights case study. Keep questioning the systems around you, and remember to look past the paperwork and into the human realities of the world we've built. We'll catch you next time.